Hey, everybody, this is Adam Shartoff, your host of FilmWax Radio. I'm proud to welcome a brand new sponsor to the podcast, the Vermont College of Fine Arts. Their MFA in film offers a two-year student design project-driven graduate program of professional mentorships for your scripts, fiction and nonfiction filmmaking, and hybrid and transmedia projects. Exciting, affordable, and intense, refine your creative vision as you develop intensely personal stories and an independent practice. Visit vcfa.edu/film for more information. Now I'll get back to them in just a little bit, but first, let's get on with this episode of the podcast. And hello again, everybody. This is your host, Adam Shartoff. Listen, thank you so much for supporting the show in 2015. It's been quite a year. I've had, I think, the best year so far. Amazing guests, great conversations, wonderful films. And so it's really been a very gratifying experience this year. What will the next year look like? I'm not so sure, but you know, I feel there's a sense of expansion, but my commitment to bringing on guests that, you know, reflect, I don't know, the great diversity of film, I guess, is continuing to be my primary goal. And I feel like I could do a lot better in some ways. I think the diversity in terms of age, in terms of genre, budget, those types of things, I do very well in. So I have, like, you know, experienced, very seasoned people on the show. I have emerging, young, less experienced people on the show. I don't know, but one thing I know where I fall short in, and that is more of a sort of a just a basic racial diversity. While I think I do a not an awful job, I could do a lot better. And so that's I would say, a priority for me and the show. If you have thoughts about that, by the way, or anything else, please do chime in and let me know. There's lots of ways to reach out to me and to the listenership. One way, of course, is on Facebook. FilmWax Radio, the podcast, has a Facebook page. Of course, I'm sure you know about that. It's just at facebook.com/FilmWax Radio. And if you haven't been there yet, or if you haven't liked the page, please give it a shot. Also, people do leave comments on our iTunes page, and as you probably know from my many times pleading with you, that if you are a subscriber or not, you can go to the iTunes page for FilmWax Radio, and you can leave a star rating and a comment. And of course, those things help move the show further up the ladder, further up the pyramid that is podcasting, and so more people will find it. Speaking of podcasts, a couple of things I wanted to point out that I've been listening to. Finally caught up with Karina Longworth's podcast, You Must Remember This, and I have to tell you, this is a really finely made podcast. I've kept hearing about it. It's one of those things where I just kept putting off, you know, listening to it. And then when I started to, I just immediately became addicted. I guess it's about Hollywood in the 20th century. So going back to the beginning, early days of Hollywood to 60s, 70s, I haven't listened to a lot of the shows, maybe just about a half dozen so far. I got caught up in the whirlwind of this Charlie Manson series, which is like, I think, 12 episodes of the series. Each one is about a half hour or so. So that's about a 6-hour production right there. Well, you know, that she did. And they're really well produced, really well written. I'm just so impressed. So we're going to have to get Karina Longworth. I used to know her. She used to be a film critic for, like, The Village Voice. And even before that, I knew her since, like, the mid-2000s. I used to see her around a lot. And I chatted with her a couple of times, but barely, you know. And then she moved out, I think, to L.A. some years ago and started writing for the L.A. Weekly. And I lost touch with what she's been doing, but I heard that she was doing this podcast. Again, it's called You Must Remember This. And if you're into film history, especially American film history, go check out Carino's podcast. It's pretty amazing. You Must Remember This. Okay, on this podcast episode, this is a really fun-packed episode we have on for his third visit to the podcast, Eric Cohen, which is great, right at the end of the year here, a kind of look back at, more at the recent titles that have come out. We talk about, Star Wars, The Force Awakens. We talk about Chirac. We talk about The Hateful Eight, a couple of other titles, The Son of Saul, and... Eric's just one of my favorite guests. He is the senior editor at IndieWire. And he has his own podcast with Ann Thompson called Screen Talk. And so I'm happy to welcome Eric Cohen back onto the podcast for his three-peat, a third of many. And we're going to have him on again in a couple of months, or towards the end of January or early February, to talk about Sundance. He's already agreed to do that. So we'll have Eric back on regularly. And then friends of mine, Lynn Sachs and Mark Street, they're a married couple. They're both filmmakers. They both make unconventional documentaries and experimental type films. So they share a lot with me, and it's a long chat. And I was really glad to bring them onto the podcast. I really enjoyed that conversation. And finally, the cinematographer, Tim Orr. Now, Tim does a lot of work with, I think he's basically been the cinematographer for, if I'm not mistaken, pretty much every David Gordon Green film. He also worked with Craig Zobel. I just actually watched Z for Zachariah, which he did the cinematography for. And so we will talk to Tim as well. That will be the final show for the calendar year of 2015. Okay, so back to Vermont College of Fine Arts, my new sponsor. Thank you very much. So let me just tell you a little bit more before we get into the show. The Vermont College of Fine Art MFA in Film offers a two-year student design project-driven graduate program of professional mentorships for your scripts, fiction and nonfiction filmmaking, and transmedia projects. Each semester begins with an on-campus residency week of screenings, workshop, lectures, and crits, along with preparation of an independent study plan of your personal projects. Then, students and faculty return home to work independently and meet monthly via Skype as projects unfold. The MFA program is designed to fit into the life you have and the films you make. Exciting, affordable, and intense. Refine your creative vision as you develop intensely personal stories in an independent practice. Again, visit vcfa.edu/film to find out more about the Vermont College of Fine Arts. Again, thank you guys for sponsoring a number of episodes that are coming up on the podcast. So let's get into this show, episode number 328. We're going to get into my conversation with Eric Cohen, senior editor of IndieWire. Let's talk to Eric Cohen. This is your, as they say now, three-peat.
Is it? Oh, yeah, I guess it is. Well, it's nice to be back. Yeah. I feel like I never left. I've just perpetually been in a podcast.
You are. So the most recent one was on Star Wars?
Mine.
Last Friday?
Screen Talk. Your podcast. Yeah. Was on, well, it's weird because I just recorded one episode, and we're about to record another episode that'll run next week while I'm on vacation.
Right.
I'm already two ahead of the one that's currently available. But yeah, the most recent episode was just like everybody else about the movie that everybody wants to know about. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. You know, sometimes you just got to do that.
Sure. No, it's a good idea. And even we were just talking about Film Spotting. They put up like a special episode. They had just walked out of their screening.
Yeah.
And then just quickly recorded a special episode because they wanted to be, you know, there's so much competition for people's attention that you want your thing to be the thing they listen to when they want to listen to something about Star Wars, I guess.
Yeah.
You know,
well,
or
I
whatever
also think,
else.
I mean, the cultural phenomenon of Star Wars is something that's very legitimate and
yeah.
worth talking about.
Well, it's a headline.
It's a headline, but it's not just there because of a certain manipulative tendency on the studio's part. The studio is pandering to some degree to a very intense desire on the part of millions of fans, and so it's a two-way conversation that has to be acknowledged. It's not like, I think, a Transformers movie or something to that effect, what the Transformers blockbuster tentpole represents, which is something that's completely soulless. It doesn't have a cultural relationship to its audience, which is what Star Wars invites. So to me, like, the conversation about not only is Star Wars good or bad, but how it's navigating fan culture is what people have been participating in over these last few months and weeks and the release of the movie. And there's a trickle-down effect where there's a bigger conversation to be had about, you know, what does this tell us about where film culture is right now and how the general public sees movies, and what can we learn from this kind of popularity about the role of the movie theater in that community today versus how other kinds of films are being, you know, perceived or not perceived. And so there's a lot of different stuff to look at with Star Wars, and I think it's actually embedded in the film itself. You know, just the way that it tells this story, it's through the lens of nostalgia. It's kind of fascinating. So
it's true. The conversation that is happening, it seems, around it is that there was much more of an imperative this time to give the audiences and all the fanboys, but also just to give them what they want, to give them something much more familiar, something much more emotionally connective that they didn't obviously feel they had to do in the last round of the last trilogy, which was introducing.
I mean, it's almost exclusively it was a George Lucas adventure. That's what I think is so amazing about it. I mean, you say what you want about those movies. I mean, personally, I thought the first two were just kind of boring and disconnected, and the third one was sort of misconceived and hokey, but at the same time had some really incredible sequences to it and a vision. Consistently throughout, it was these were the movies that George Lucas wanted to make, and nobody else could do anything about that.
No, it's very true, but you could say that for this next trilogy, but it's not sticking quite to the script, as far as I know.
I don't think that any single person has the autonomy to make big creative decisions in relation to the franchise as it stands now. That was what happened with the $4 billion deal that Disney made for this enterprise. I mean, I think it's cool that directors like Rian Johnson or Gareth Edwards can play around in that universe, and there's certainly a lot of material there. And as far as the expanded universe goes, if you look at the comic books or the video games that have come out over the last 20 plus years,
the animated series,
I mean, there's been a lot of that for a while, and there's a lot of great potential that most people, unless you're a diehard fan, haven't fully appreciated. And so I think that aspect of it is really cool. It's just, you know, again, it's not a singular artistic vision. It's a franchise that has a big sandbox where different people can try things out. So it's more like, not even a sandbox, it's more like a laboratory for experimentation, but there are limits to that experimentation, where it's like with the George Lucas version of Star Wars, it was one person's particular way of wanting to tell the story, and all the, you know, various kinds of flaws that entailed. So I think it's very interesting, too, because if you draw a contrast between that kind of autonomy and what all kinds of other filmmakers do, it's not as big of a line. I mean, it's more about just what kind of stories different people are telling than it is about, you know, Hollywood versus the indies and so forth. And in some ways, it's a much more provocative question. I mean, you know, you look at the Rick Alversons of the world. I mean, Rick Alverson, who made entertainment and comedy and all these kinds of movies, would never make a Star Wars movie. Why would he never make a Star Wars movie? Because this is somebody who wants to make very particular kinds of movies with a creative agenda, and has his own kind of universe or logic to the kinds of narratives that he's constructing. And I personally respond to those more so than I do to the George Lucas prequels. But I don't think that there is really a separate agenda in terms of what's driving these people. They're both creatives trying to do something unlike anything else that's out there. And so, you know, I think George Lucas, what's fascinating about him is that his roots are the avant-garde film scene in San Francisco in the late 60s. And if he really wants to kind of legitimize himself on that front, he should pour money back into that world. I mean, the one kind of neglected arena of, at least in New York, I think, of filmmaking is in that doesn't get enough love is what's going on in the experimental space and the ways in which filmmakers who are so explicitly non-commercial are struggling to get by and don't necessarily get the exposure or the resources they deserve for the work that they're doing, because it's very hard to categorize what kind of work we're talking about here.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you could almost say that Rick's work, speaking of Rick, is falls into almost an experimental.
Yeah.
It's sort of it might have at one time been considered, if they didn't have, like, celebrities, some stars in it that are in the more recent one.
It's a related agenda, absolutely, to the avant-garde space and just trying to create something that's different, that challenges expectations, that plays with our understanding of the world or shows us a new one in a completely uncompromising way. That's always more exciting to me than the alternative, which is just the most traditional kind of pat narrative experience you could ask for. When I shrug and I say, you know, like, oh, it was fine. I mean, that's usually in reaction to a movie that at least is trying to better than average. And just in general. Mm-hmm. I mean, let's say the new Star Wars movie. I would say, like, yeah, it's fine. Mm-hmm. That reaction is more, I mean, if this was such a stereotypical piece of filmmaking, then I don't think I would react that way. I think I would say it was, you know, boring and just, you know, unadventurous or something to that effect.
It may, I probably couldn't separate the nostalgic from the, you know, the actual specific quality of the film. I, you know, in 1977, my dad took me to see, you know, A New Hope. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it sort of like changed my life, you know, like it did every other, you know, 12-year-old or whatever. It just changed our lives. So going into the movie theater and seeing that on the screen, you know. So even though my kid had, Jacob, who's 11, had seen all six other chapters, you know, not many times on DVD, on a small screen, I hadn't taken him to a Star Wars. So this was in a way exactly, I was the exact prototype for this movie in the sense that here it is now, I'm repeating the same cycle,
right?
Much like the Star Wars cycle, father and son theme going on. So I'm connecting on this meta level by sitting with my son and, you know, watching this together.
We're, I mean, both really, that seems like it's, that was a very popular American pastime over the past week, was fathers and sons going to Korean Star Wars together.
Yeah.
And I like that. But, you know, I also like the idea of, you know, what might that stimulate next, you know, in 10 to 15 years when the son realizes that the same year that Episode 4 came out, Eraserhead was released, and, you know, being able to discover an experience like that wouldn't necessarily work when you're at an age where you're still kind of waking up to the world and you know, there are certain things that you can't fully understand, and so you need spectacle and bright colors and easy plot lines and so forth. And so I look at these kinds of movies and the enthusiasm they inspire as some kind of a gateway to a more complex relationship to this art form. And in that sense, I think they can be valuable when they're good enough. And that's what I mean by, you know, it's when something's fine, you know, it's just good enough, it's at least trying to do something with moving images that inspires a way of thinking about this kind of art, and maybe that can lead to even better, more advanced kinds of art at different stages of one's life. And I mean, it's not my kind of movie, you know. I mean, I'm more excited about a new Tarantino movie, even when it doesn't work, because Tarantino is doing something else. But I wouldn't expect the same kind of rabid fandom that, you know, the Star Wars movies inspire. Doesn't mean that I think that kind of fandom is bad. It's just that I think that it's representative of a more kind of immediate and simplified relationship to a movie. It's not a bad relationship, but it's not asking as much of you. You know, it's more like
And also the world. I mean, right now the culture isn't necessarily being asked to do very much. And that's it, you know. So I understand it's not so much of an exception. Back when Star Wars came out, you could also go see a Lizzie Borden film. Or I mean, there was a lot of other things that were that had audiences. I mean,
right.
But there were maybe at that time, I don't know, would also maybe be a small independent film, might also be in a movie theater, Cassavetes film, I don't know, you know, in a movie theater for a really long time, playing across the street or in the same theater, pretend, you know, as Star Wars, which is not really quite so much today, especially if you're not living in a big city, you know. So maybe, you know, what you're saying is you're, ideally there would be more provocative films, more films that are trying to, that are asking, to use what you said, asking more of its audience.
Yeah.
Maybe?
Yeah, I think, I mean, my feeling is more just that there's something about a movie like Star Wars or the kind of experience that represents that is not mm-hmm. designed to challenge people. Mm. And I like movies that challenge
people.
And so I think it's, these are the building blocks of a language of sorts, mm-hmm. and then there are bigger questions about how do you apply that language to other kinds of experiences. But I don't hold anything against anyone who gets something out of just the most rudimentary pieces of that language. You know, sometimes we disengage in cocktail chatter, and sometimes we talk philosophy. So, you know, both of those things are valid.
Yeah, for sure. That is human nature. I have not seen Chirac at this point, mm-hmm. so I'm going to try to see it.
That's a during the transition,
non-Jewish
right?
holidays.
But it's much more interesting to talk about.
We talk about Star Wars, not we don't. You know, are we talking around Star Wars?
Yeah, too? Well, no, but yeah. I like the idea of going because I think Chirac also a flawed film, but I mean it's got a lot going on that is. Trying to challenge you to think about not only the message that it's delivering, but how it's delivering that message. You're thinking about the way that this particular creator is expressing himself. I mean, just the use of Lysistrata to tell a story about mm-hmm. gang violence in Chicago is absurd, and yet at the same time, there's this kind of intensity to it. It's on one hand shrill, and at the same time, actually exciting and tense and funny and macabre and all these different elements. I mean, it feels actually like Godardian in a way, but also it's like a consolidation of a lot of different things we've seen Spike Lee do, from the satire of Bamboozled and the musicality element of School Days to obviously Do the Right Thing, the way that deals with, you know, violent tendencies in lower class African-American communities and so forth. So it's a movie that's just rich with desire to express a certain perspective. And that I think is always really great. I mean, no matter where you find it, anything that kind of inhabits a particular point of view is a better piece of cinema or art than something that's devoid of it.
And seems to be connected, at least with the people that have obviously who have seen it so far. I don't know the numbers of people that have seen it, but it seems like they're actually discussing the movie for once, and not get, you know, normally you don't get past the topic of Spike Lee when discussing a Spike Lee movie.
Yeah.
Whereas this time they're actually excited to talk about the film. At least that's
I mean, it's definitely Spike's been generating a lot of press around this thing, and it's not surprising, and it's a work of activism, or so mm-hmm. he says. Mm-hmm. But you know, Spike Lee is a real filmmaker, and I think because he's famous and is in some ways a brand, that tends to hijack focus on this original point. I mean, but you look at a lot of the movies in this career, and it's just, I mean, there is no movie that this man has made that doesn't have some very specific decisions being made about camera work, about and about colors and tone. It's a very rich filmography. Even when the movies are terrible,
I would say the same thing. I walked out and kind of grateful after I saw the Red Hook Summer, you know, which probably the fewest people have seen of the last bunch of movies. But I, in a way, kind of grateful at the same mm-hmm. time, because I'm thinking, you know. Yeah, it's a big, in some ways it fails like spectacularly, but on another level it's like, it going back to what you said before, it's asking things of me And, you know, at first that was kind of annoying because I was uncomfortable with this language that he was using in a way. You know, and so I guess I agree with that. You know, speaking of that, also, even though I wouldn't say it was a work of activism by any stretch, Hateful Eight is still, in terms of the amount of accessibility Tarantino is giving, he's couching a lot of the talk around the film as about racism and where we're at in this country.
Yeah, I kind of wish that Tarantino and Spike Lee would make up, because I know that...
Wouldn't that be nice?
I mean, those guys have bad beef, and it's never going to be resolved, because they're intense personalities driven to some degree by their public demagogue stature, and also have... real
it's Game of Thrones
just
here.
Like each other. Yeah, I mean, it's, but you know, it's weird because they're of slightly different generations. They're, they're very different kinds of filmmakers. I mean, Spike's been making movies for 30 years. Tarantino's been making them for about 20, but has only made 8 movies and has a, you know, he makes kind of these fun, wacky entertainment. Spike Lee works across a broad spectrum, but also has this kind of polemical quality to the kinds of stories that he's been telling always. There's sort of, it's enmeshed with his persona, and whereas Tarantino at least acts as though that polemical perspective is secondary to the kind of the cinema itself and the entertainment value that comes out of it. But what I think it is too bad about that is that this is a filmmaker who I think, in spite of the way that he talks about it, is not throwing, you know, racial epithets into his screenplay just for pure provocative nature or for political libertarian-esque reasons involving freedom of speech, but rather to confront real questions about the role of race in American society. And even though I think on some level Hateful Eight might be one of his weaker movies, it asks those questions better than any I've seen, including Django, which is a more fluid experience, but does not include a character with as complex an identity as Samuel Jackson's bounty hunter in Hateful Eight, somebody who's got this really fascinating, you know, Civil War background and this remarkable, absurdist, prolonged monologue where he basically tells off this and then subsequently takes action against this this former general, which to me is very similar to the kind of the mentality of Inglourious Basterds, where, you know, it's like a voice from the past confronting history in a way that never actually happened but probably should have, you know? And I think that there's maybe something unfortunate about our society that more people can't see that, and even more frustrating that Spike Lee can't see that. And that those two guys can't operate on the same wavelength and talk about how they're both essentially confronting questions that society hasn't totally worked out yet.
Speaking of Samuel L. Jackson, maybe he's the one that can bring these, I mean, I'm sure he's been asked to bring these two guys together,
right?
He would make the most
heal
sense.
The rift. I did think about that while I was watching.
You were? You did,
Hateful
rather?
Eight. I was, because I saw Chirac, I think, the day before or something like that, and I was like, yeah, that's a lot of SLJ, and he's
maybe
good in both.
Steve Buscemi might have at one point, but I think that's now off the table. Like, I think he's too far removed from both of those.
I don't see it happening. They're just too intense in terms of personalities. I mean, what is there even left to say? You know, I mean, I just feel like there's just something. I remember watching Abel Ferrara and Werner Herzog make up, right, because of the whole Bad Lieutenant thing. But those are that was a misunderstanding involving a producer who kind of took advantage of one of them and then took advantage of the other one, and, you know, was kind of playing both sides against each other, and they didn't know each other.
Just for those who are listening, I guess Werner Herzog made a sequel.
It was like a remake.
It was like a remake
of Bad Lieutenant.
It's called Port of Call with Nick
Cage. Right,
that's
where he added it on there. But but it was Ed Pressman was the producer who had this idea of franchising it of sorts.
Oh, I see.
And Herzog, you know, claimed he'd never heard of the original one. I'm inclined to actually believe that, but I mean, the point is that these guys were kind of speaking through the press at each other, but in different directions. And when Herzog found himself at the same table as Ferrara, was very honest about it and said, sorry about all this stuff. I didn't know. It was his producer, blah, 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 blah. Farrar's was just sort of like, look, you know, this is Werner Herzog. You know, I watch his movies. He doesn't have to watch my movies. He doesn't owe me an apology. It's that stupid producer guy who did this thing. Right. Like that. The only point I'm making there is as a comparison is like those two artists had a specific reason to be frustrated with something that each of them had done and a very clean way to resolve it. Whereas with Spike Lee and Quentin Tarantino, there is no clean way to resolve it. But audiences can by seeing those movies and reconciling those worldviews because I think they're actually very complementary.
Well said. Since we're winding down, well, not only the conversation potentially, but just
at
the year of 2015.
Here it goes.
Yeah. And you're heading off to Seattle, for the last
that's my own hometown.
Days. Is there any other particular films that you feel strongly about?
Well, in terms of things that are out right now, I'm still thinking a lot about how good Creed wound up being. I think it's just a really accomplished, well-rounded piece of narrative filmmaking that, you know, isn't my favorite kind of filmmaking per se, and I'm not even a diehard Rocky fan, but I just thought it was just so immaculately done that, you know, it was a reminder of how this formula can work when it works well and how rarely we see it these days.
Is this just another imagine? You figure this is what happens when you take a filmmaker like Ryan Coogler, right, who did Fruitvale Station, right? A few years ago?
Fruitvale was his first film.
And then he got this gig, right? And I wonder how much of it was... I wonder how that came. Do you know how that came about? Even like how this, like this
my understanding. I mean, I you know, it's I'm just paying lip service to the PR campaign. Sure. But my understanding is that this was sort of a dream project that he conceived when he was younger. Like, what happened to Apollo Creed's son? And then wrote a script based on that. And you know how it is. Somebody makes the first feature. It's very strong. They get an agent. That script gets passed around. I think at some point he had to pitch it to Stallone. But it feels like that kind of a movie. I mean,
it's almost like a franchise, too.
Well, it absolutely is. It's a Rocky franchise, but it's a Rocky franchise rejiggled in certain ways to put Stallone in the supporting role and tap into some of the original appeal of that franchise that's lasted 40-plus years while shifting focus to a new character, a black character that feels a little bit more contemporary in certain ways. He's young and has in some ways grown up with the Rocky legacy in his life in the way that viewers may have. I mean, Star Wars does that too, you know, this whole like, oh, Luke Skywalker, I thought he was a myth, you know, it's like,
right, yes,
this is a guy in Creed who is like rehearsing his boxing techniques, watching old Rocky fights on YouTube, Rocky and Apollo fights on YouTube. You know, and it just feels
like.
And
then he's
in
the room with Rocky. And exactly. It works on so many different levels.
So it's like merging like fantasy and real life in a very smart way, I think.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I like that movie a lot. I mean, look, my favorite movie
I
of the year.
I gotta go to that too now.
Yeah. My favorite movie of the year, full stop, is Son of Saul, which is not a Holocaust movie in any traditional sense, though you always, unfortunately, every conversation must start with that framework.
Right, of course.
I think the best way to think of it is it's just a bracing piece of filmmaking that happens to take place in a concentration camp. And you've never seen it portrayed this way. I have seen it twice. I rescreened it recently for my NYU students, and most of the reactions were positive, but I think all the reactions were that people were riveted by just sort of the nature of the filmmaking there. And I loved coming back to that movie. I think that in spite of what somebody was saying to me when I said this once before, it's not just a movie about death, it's about survival. It's just about being swept into the process of survival in a way that happens to involve lots of death. And it doesn't take anything for granted while also trusting the audience's intelligence to fill in the blanks.
Yeah.
You're mostly in close-up with this character, and so you
this is a Polish...
Hungarian. Laszlo Nemes is the director. It's the first feature. Mm-hmm. He won the runner-up prize at Cannes. I just thought it was a spectacular piece of cinema. That was my favorite movie of the year by far. And I rewatched it just, you know, like 2 weeks ago, having not seen it since May, and just wanted to confirm that it was as good as I thought, and it was.
So. And this is the time you screened it with your students, so you were not exactly. Like that, you're watching it through their eyes,
exactly.
Too.
Exactly. And, you know, talk about counter-programming to Star Wars.
So. Did the students have to keep saying, what do they call you, Eric? Do they call you Professor? What do they call you?
Everybody chooses their own.
Do they kept saying, Professor, stop saying, wait for this part. Yeah. Wait until you see this part.
I don't
part.
Do that during screenings. I'm not that
oh,
guy.
You aren't?
No.
That comes as a complete shock to
no,
me.
I always wait until afterwards. Love asking people what they thought about something and then mm-hmm. kind of debating it. I think the conversations are exciting, and especially when people disagree about stuff, but I wouldn't, you know, interrupt the viewing experience itself. You know, I need the complete work.
I was trying to be silly, but, you know.
No. Yeah. I mean, I certainly wouldn't do it there. You know, like, wait till that part where, you know, this person gets shot in the head. You know?
I mean, but the whole thing, I know I've been reading about it, and God knows I was invited to my share of screenings, but it's like so many films, there is a certain percentage of my world that where I just, for some reason, it's just not going to, I don't know, I can't get there. So I'm using the last days of the year just to catch up a little bit.
Yeah.
And the only thing is, that keeps me is like, it is hard to go to put yourself through such a devastating story like that.
Right.
But I understand the other side of it is that you come out somehow having sat through an emotionally rich story and incredible acting, and then you're on the other side of it, and you're like, oh, my life is a little bit better now.
Yeah. I would say, you know, see Star Wars. And then go to the other side. Get that out of the way.
See Creed if you have to. You know, just
you work your way towards the more extreme kind of things that I'll endorse. But, you know, getting a broad spectrum of experiences is something that I think is very valuable for everyone. So.
Well, have a happy New Year. And, I guess maybe I'll see you when you get... I will. Of course I will.
I'll be back. And then we can talk about Sundance.
I know.
Around the corner.
That'd be great. Thank you.
Already upon us.
Thanks.
Hello, wonderful listener. My name is Henry Rollins, and you are listening to Film Wax Radio. Touch yourself, touch your friends, but don't touch that dial.
Let's see. I've known Lynn Sachs for a number of years now. We have mutual friends, and then it turns out that I didn't know this when I met her, but she also happens to be the sister of Ira Sachs, who's been on the show a number of times. And she is married to Mark Street, who is another filmmaker who is roughly my age, and so we have a lot in common, and it was great to meet up with the pair. Oh, and I should mention, as by way of a disclaimer, that I am indeed working with, and Lynn makes mention of this in a conversation, but I have been involved with a film project that Lynn is working on, which she refers to, and which I'll talk about more when the film is coming out and available and all that, so when, where, and how people can see it. So let's go into my conversation with the filmmakers and married couple, Lynn Sachs and Mark Street. I think the cat is really cute, but he's a psychotic cat. So you were describing the cat.
I was pathologizing him, I think, what I was doing.
Such a sweetheart, though. I just like animals.
Well,
what will he do? What will happen? Like, what will the cat do? Because right now he's just...
Well, I mean...
What will he do that? You know?
Well, Lynn just walked upstairs with the thing that he does that's irritating. He pees on my things.
Oh, he does?
Yes.
Oh, I see.
That changes things for you, doesn't
it?
Yeah,
it really does.
Yeah.
If a cat peed on anything of mine, I would probably have it put down.
But he's 10, 12, 13, I don't know what he is. But, I mean, it's just like, it's incredible. It's like, you know, put a book down, I'll put my shoes down, I'll put, and you,
you're
it only has to happen once, and you're like, no.
Yeah, there's not, you don't need a cat to pee on something two or three times.
Exactly. And then you go to the vet.
Right now, the cat is licking you.
Well, that looks great, but you know. Anyway, and then you go to the vet and they go, well, are you stressing him out?
Yeah.
I'm like,
they take the cat side immediately.
They totally do. Except for my last vet, who I love. She said, so he's being a jerk. I was like, yes, you are a good vet.
Right.
So he's being a jerk.
I want the guy who's paying the bills to get the sympathy, not the cat.
Totally. Totally.
When the cat pays the bill, then that's fine. Right? It's a cat with a lot of character, though. That cat, what's the cat's name?
Moonlight.
Moonlight. Moonlight, I'm going to post a shot or two. I'll figure out. We'll put on the Facebook, because you're on Facebook, Mark. Because he has a lot of character, but with that comes...
I'll take some water, too, Lynn, and there's some bubbly water right there if you want it. Adam, you want water or anything?
I guess so. Sure, thank you.
Yeah.
But I want Lynn's company. We're in Carroll Gardens, the home of Lynn Sachs and Mark Street. Just, you know, and as I told you before, this is a neighborhood that I have a lot of history in because I lived just a couple blocks away from the 87 and 93, my first apartment in New York. My landlord's name was Walter Romansky. He owned 307. He had the third floor. I had the second floor. There was, for a while, an illegal sublet on the ground floor. Some NYU college students lived there, and then there was a couple of people that lived there. But it was a storefront apartment. But he rented it as a residential apartment. But no real heat. I mean, there was a space heater that heated the whole place. And you would just hear the F train and the G train running downstairs 24/7. But, you know, it's my first apartment, you know.
It's great.
$650, shared it for a while, and then ultimately took it over.
When I first moved to New York City.
This is Lynn Sachs.
I lived in what we used to call an illegal sublet on the Upper East Side that had belonged to a nurse who worked at a hospital, and she got fired, so she was angry at the hospital, and she never told the housing office that she was moving from New York City, and I knew her brother, and he said, if you want to live in New York City for $200 a month in a one-bedroom apartment, I got the place for you.
What year?
That was in 1984.
Wow.
Yeah. So I beat you on the cheaper apartment.
You did. You have anything remotely like that? Where'd you grow up again, Mark Street?
I grew up in Wisconsin.
That's right. You're from Wisconsin.
You know, I don't remember my rent when I moved out of my parents' house in a huff. Beloit, right on the border of Illinois. But it was a lot cheaper than $200 or $650, I'll tell you that. No, I can't beat that. I can't beat any of the prices you guys are mentioning.
Are we all, like, roughly in the same age sphere? I don't know.
I'm 52.
We have more in common than you think. I just remembered something that you don't know about you and me that we share. We went to Bard at the same time. Well, I didn't stay for more than a year. But my freshman year, you might have been there, because we're the same age.
It's ringing a bell.
Because I know one other guy that was there too, Jim Brown. But I didn't know that Jim Brown was there, and he's been
Jim's
on the show.
Probably my best friend in the world.
Really?
Yeah.
He's an asshole, though. How does that work out? No, Jim Brown is doing God's work. We know that. Because
he's an asshole, but he's doing God's
work.
Right.
Yeah. Because, no, I mean, the guy distributes, like, artistic, beautiful, and then music films. And, I mean, come on.
So you went there for a year?
I went the most dramatic year ever, first of all. So that was one thing. It was very intense. Secondly, it was so small. You know that. That year, 81, 82, 82, 83, what year was that? That we would have been. It was the year that the program of language and thinking began.
Yeah.
So you were there, right?
I was there. Maybe I was there.
We had to know each other.
Yeah.
Oh, maybe did you take a year off or something? I was 17.
Yeah.
When I showed up.
You were early and I was late. That's the deal.
Okay.
Oh, are you 52?
No. Yeah. I just turned 52. Well, and this is all being edited out there.
I took a gap year, as they call it.
Oh, okay.
We used to call it fucking around and not knowing what the hell you're doing. But I did that.
Okay.
And you...
I went straight into DeBard.
Yeah.
So we did not have a year... Because then after a year, I was like, I can't deal with it. I was... Yeah. I found
especially
it so...
Especially from New York City, it must have been...
Yeah, but I went to summer camp, as Lynn knows, and only too well. Not so far away. Walt Kill wasn't so far from Rhinecliff and Rhinebeck, that area. And so I knew a lot of people... Like, I had a lot of history with there, so I thought that would be enough to... make it work, but it, and also the size of it felt, especially during the language and thinking program, that first year, it was so intimate that I felt like you were going to camp together.
Did they call it language and thinking?
The
writing and thinking.
Just a minute.
What was it called?
In our day, you didn't go there.
What it was
in
called?
Our day, they called it reading and thinking.
Oh,
they
no.
They called it reading and drinking.
Well, you had the advantage of a year...
Yeah,
head
that's
start.
When we find it. Yeah. Reading and drinking.
Hold it a little closer. But
reading and drinking.
But no, it was called language. The something of language and thinking.
LRT or something. Yeah.
Yeah. Leon Botstein, who is still known as a conductor and a well-known classical musical figure, he was the youngest at the time president of a private college or any college perhaps in the United States. And it was the year, and I hope he forgives me if he's listening, that was the year that his wife had an affair with...
Doug Boz.
Oh, no, I had a different name.
Oh, my God. She was such a runaround Sue.
She's a whore.
Cut that out.
No, Anders, Professor Anders, who was my... He was denied tenure.
Well, the joke is that... I don't know. The joke is that later on, Botstein's wife had an affair with Doug Boz, who was a photography professor, and he didn't get tenure. So it becomes this plausible deniability kind of thing.
I see. Well,
I see.
Botstein himself was no slouch in the promiscuity department.
Oh, really? Really?
Okay. I was not in the Bard aura during that time.
Where were you?
I was up in Providence, Rhode Island.
Were you going to Brown? Oh, very good.
So it was a bigger place, and you didn't feel as caught in by the web.
Right, and I think I would have been better in a bigger place. And an Ivy League sounds good, but I don't think I had the grades for it. Mm-hmm. But I was an artsy guy, and Bard was into that, I guess. Well, I'm sorry to go off on a tangent, but it was also a very difficult year because there was a tragedy that occurred on the campus, but I don't want to talk about that because somebody might... Yeah, the daughter. But I will say that I had run into Botstein sometime after that. In fact, I just went to Bard last summer, not this past summer, but the one before, because my ex was in a play there at the New Art Center, which is this incredible. It was not there. It was not there when you and I were there. They had this little dump kind of depressing place.
Near Tewksbury. Yeah.
Yes, Tewksbury, which was my dorm.
Oh, my
and,
God.
So I hadn't been back. And so she said she went to a party, and I was with the kids. And she said, yeah, Botstein was there. And I said, oh, geez, after all this time, I could have talked to him. But I had seen him in New York, like at concerts once in a while. And I did approach him, and he was so warm and nice. And he was so glad to hear that, you know, that I was at Bard, and he wondered, you know, yes. And then I also ran into Anders, Professor Anders, who was my, also my, what do they call him? The teacher that you would, you know, office hours.
Advisor.
He was my college advisor, too, for a very short, that 1 year. So it was a very, very intense thing to go on. And I was 17, I turned 18 in that year, really just too young. You know, for a place like that, for that kind of stuff going on. So that's that. So the thought was that I was intrigued by your relationship. I was intrigued by the fact that you both are doing such personal, experimental, non-conventional length films. Totally unconventional. Yet you seem to really have carved out a place for yourselves. And I was thinking how much of that you guys are... You know, how much is because of the marriage and because of your relationship and you support each other and you work off that energy you've created, or maybe that has very little to do with it. You said, Lynn, earlier when we were at dinner, that you had met in San Francisco. right? And you were in the circles with like Jay Rosenblatt, who's been on this podcast, and Kaveh, was he there too? I don't know. Wait, there was a circle of filmmakers.
So we met in San Francisco at the end of 1991, and we were both very, very involved in the alternative experimental film scene that was so celebrated in San Francisco. And
yeah.
In San Francisco, I would say, and this is in, kind of in contrast to New York, it wasn't that doing that was making a statement as in, I'm not in the indie scene. It was just that you were making films because there wasn't really much of an industry. So if you were making films, you were and you chose to stay in San Francisco, then you were part of a movement that was about personal expression.
Yeah, you were more, if anything, probably more, you know, inside of the art with artists and gallery.
Yes. And it wasn't on. It didn't feel like you were on the fringe,
right?
Because so many people were doing that.
For people me, show up.
Yeah, for me, the vortex of all of that was around Other Cinema and Craig Baldwin and the kind of storefront film screenings where, oh, you're happy when 15 people arrive or 50 if there's room, and everybody was there to talk about their movies, and that wasn't a novelty. It was just sort of the way it was. And so I was there long enough, and I think we met in that, the spinning of all that, that it was kind of affirming to meet someone who believed in the same thing you did and was willing to go to the same movies and excited about it. And so I will just say that I was putting together a film screening that I was going to take to the heart of Utah, strangely enough. And I asked Mark if I could borrow a 16-millimeter print of his. And I went over to his house, and that was the beginning of 24 years.
Right into the flirtation.
Yes.
Mode. Right?
Yeah, I mean, I'll say that I agree with everything you said, Lynn. And there was... It was a really fertile time in San Francisco. It was a wonderful place to live after college. It felt cheap, believe it or not. It felt like you could live in a house with five different people, and you could eat cheaply and buy burritos and things like that. The institutions that were there, the Cinematheque, the Film Arts Foundation, were my new home, you know, and I would rent. At that point, you would rent equipment, you would rent cameras, you would rent flatbeds from them, mm-hmm. you would show work there, and it meant a lot to me, you know. I think that in the digital age, I miss that. I miss the sort of institutions that support filmmakers on a variety of levels. Film Arts Foundation is defunct now. And I will say, just to be... you know, sort of a little bit, to not romanticize the past, I think that, you know, there were still competitions and there's still irritations and there's still feelings of being left out and, you know, why didn't they show this film and that, you know, I think it, for me, I don't romanticize that time as much, maybe, or not that you're romanticizing it, but I think we always had a different relationship to the social scene of filmmaking, and you were always more of a joiner than I was, and I appreciate that, you know, because I think
maybe engaged.
Hmm.
It's almost like has a negative connotation. Joining, like engaged socially, more engaged, comfortable. Is that what you're getting at?
Yeah, I mean, our first date was seeing a great friend of ours, Ellen Berliner's film.
Just drove down from Woodstock with him last weekend.
Oh, wonderful.
Took him back to New York.
Yeah, I mean, the story is that we went to see his films, short films, including Nobody's Intimate Stranger.
Intimate Stranger.
Wow. At the Cinematheque, and that was our first date. And we watched the films, and I was enthralled, and we heard the Q&A, and then I was
like... Isn't the one about his dad?
That's about his grandfather, his paternal uncle.
Oh, his uncle.
His uncle who was a Japanese.
No, grandfather. I think it was his. Yeah. Yeah. I think it was grandfather.
I'm wrong.
Yeah. Anyway, sorry. We'll cut it out. Nobody will. You'll have heard that mistake.
That's okay. That's okay. I'm willing to be wrong. But anyway, Lynn and I went and we heard the Q&A and I was ready to go. And Lynn said, I want to stay and socialize. And it's been that way for the last 24 years.
Well, those are two different things. Being a joiner and socialize, being more of a social butterfly, those are two different things, aren't they, a little bit?
Yeah.
Like, you can be antisocial and be a joiner.
In my defense, I wouldn't necessarily have said, oops, that I was there to socialize. But the thing was in San Francisco that there were just so many interesting people of all different ages. For example, Barbara Hammer taught both of us about optical printing. And George Kuchar was around.
Oh, my gosh.
And,
yeah.
You know, Bruce Conner and people who were monumental in the world of avant-garde film. And they were just all there doing their thing. And we happened to be whatever number of years younger. And it didn't matter at all. Mm-hmm. You know, George made a number of movies where he was into our relationship. So he one time came over to our house and he wanted us. Mark had made split pea soup, and of course there was an image of the split pea soup in his film, and then he had us dance, kind of make-believe ballroom dancing, and if we just, it was in the moment and we loved it. And then, you know, now years later I feel, whoa, what, how lucky that we had all that time with George Kuchar, who's one of the visionary, outlandish alternative filmmakers.
I can see it in your work as you describe it. I mean, I can see it.
Yeah, it was so important and so informal. So for me, I don't mind romanticizing that period in San Francisco. And I also worked with a whole documentary group, too, that Mark wasn't as involved with. So I worked a lot with Trenti Minha and, like, Babette Mangold, who shot, films with Chantal Ackerman and other people. Mm-hmm. And I learned cinematography for her. So they were all coming through, too. And so it was just very rich also because people at that time who were studying filmmaking also were studying theory. And so that was extremely important to me too. So that the spin and Jay Rosenblatt and I were in a film theory class together. And so it was very poignant because we both stuck with experimental film, but that theory kind of feeds through our work, I think.
Yeah, and because it was pre-indie film and way pre-documentary as a legitimate category of, like, independent film and of Oscar. I mean, you know, way before that. I imagine it only strengthened the bonds of the community around it because, you know, there was no infrastructure otherwise. I mean, right? You like, now there's just this huge, I mean, every week, and then if you read the reviews, there's 3 or 4 new documentaries.
Well, I mean, I want to say that it's important to I guess I'm a skeptic, and I think that it's not like there wasn't an institution there. I mean, there was an institution of avant-garde film, and I think the institution of avant-garde film can be as constraining and as constricting as anything else. And I fought against it in San Francisco. And I remember, you know, trying to make a longer film and a narrative film and people saying, well, you've gone narrative, you know.
Oh, right.
There's a purism to the avant-garde. Mm-hmm. And one can't say that the avant-garde appeared in San Francisco out of nowhere, you know? I mean, you can go back to Rosalind Krauss and her book, The Originality of the Avant-Garde and Other Modernist Myths, you know? And it's the idea that people are inventing something new, whereas, in fact, it's entrenched, right? And it was entrenched in San Francisco since Sidney Peterson in the 30s and 40s at the San Francisco Art Institute. And there was a tradition there. It's a tradition I loved and I embraced, but I think there's a lot to fight against there as well.
Well, did they?
And I appreciate fighting against things.
Did they? The rest?
Did who?
Well, I mean, like you're pushing back a little bit, sounds like. So I'm wondering what the reaction to the pushing back was, or do they encourage that?
Mark remembers this. Mark made a lot of diary films back then.
Yeah.
That were very, and you've seen some of them, mm-hmm. and they were very confessional and very raw in a way, and didn't always follow certain kinds of like strictures of like the identity politics and politically correct kinds of things. And I would say that maybe as open-minded as the avant-garde world was, mm-hmm. it implicit to that was a kind of like you don't break the rules of racism, sexism, you know, when do you show a woman's body and all of that. So I remember you had some kind of contretemps around that.
Well, as I recall, sweetheart, they involved you not programming that film. There was a screening committee of Laura Poitras, who was a friend of ours in San Francisco, mm-hmm. and Lynn, and who was the third programmer?
Steve Anker.
But they were looking at films together, and they looked at my diary film, and as Laura Poitras told me later, there was a scene in my film of my ex-girlfriend at Bard putting mud on her breasts, mm-hmm. and she said, I can't program this film when I see, you know, someone putting mud on her breasts, red flags go up. Mm-hmm. So,
in terms of the audience,
no, in terms
because they're
of kind
of like there's a politics to
an orthodoxy.
Yeah, well, that's what I mean. Not her own personal. She wasn't necessarily. Was she suggesting she was offended, or was she? Saying,
I think she was suggesting she was offended, but you'd have to ask her.
Sometimes it's like, well, the community will be offended. We can't.
Well,
do this.
Who the hell knows the difference? But
I
maybe
would say, and this was before Mark and I were a couple, in any way. But I would say that Laura and I thought it was sexist
mm-hmm.
at the time. So we, I think definitions or. Of feminism have really changed now, yeah. and there's the whole idea, yes, a man can be a feminist, or yes, a man celebrating the body of a woman is also a fantastic thing. He's very open and comfortable with his desires, mm-hmm. but maybe we weren't so open-minded at the time.
I understand. Right. Everything in its time. You're just ahead of your time, Mark. Were you aware of the Ed Pincus and... The confessional diaries work that he was doing, and
I wasn't at that point. I need to see those films more. I loved mm-hmm. his book, you know.
Mm-hmm. He wrote the sort of the Bible, right? Didn't he?
Yeah, and I would read that mm-hmm. like literally before bed. And but I don't know those films as well.
Okay.
And I've wanted to catch up with them, but I haven't. Yeah.
Well, there was just diaries, which you know is like, I don't know. I may have seen something else too, but that was sort of the thing that, you know, this very 3-hour confessional period where in the 60s, it's incredible.
Yeah.
It's incredible stuff to see, but a lot of filmmakers, there's a whole lineage that come from those, you know, that were very inspired by mm-hmm. him in his early films.
I mean...
Before he went into Raising Flowers,
because
he left filmmaking and became a flower farmer.
Good place to be. It's interesting, you know, in a given time, what filmmakers give you permission to do what you want to do. Kuchar, at that mm-hmm. time, definitely. You know, Joe Gibbons then mm-hmm. and later on, or actually earlier at Bard College, mm-hmm. was just a huge influence. I remember Anne Robertson, Charlotte Robertson, came to the Cinematheque and gave these amazing performances that dealt with her own mental illness and her own mm-hmm. kind of, you know, and it meant so much to me. I just felt like it was beyond the avant-garde. It was beyond documentary. It was a new permission, you know. I think at any time in your life, it's interesting to sort of think, oh, that kind of film gives me permission to do what the hell I want to do, you know.
Well, how does the relationship, I mean, where does it, your marriage and your relationship leak into the art making? you know, obviously checking out each other's work. I mean, it's likely that you're showing each other your, or maybe you're talking about ideas and, you know, for projects and bouncing that off each other. But what kind of things that I can't,
you know, being in a relationship with, just in a general sense, who, with a person who does very much the same, or let's say has the same avocation, vocation that you have, because we both teach and we both make films, it adds like a spirit and a constant conversation. And other times you feel kind of envious of people who are in relationships in which there's more of a complementary kind of dynamic, where I don't know anything about this and you do, and oh, you know how to fix the toilet and I know how to do the electricity. Mm-hmm. It's sort of like we know a lot of the same things.
Mm.
But that's just in the most obvious way, you know, if you looked at what our skill set was. But in other ways, our whole approach to our art making is very, very, very different. And so that can kind of be both intriguing and also can create like a friction. Like, why do you work with other people? Why don't you work by yourself? Why don't you do this? And why, you know, we challenge each other. But mm-hmm. then actually yesterday, I had read something in the New York Times on Sunday, and I came down and I said to Mark, why don't you look into this? I think it's very relevant to the work you're doing in North Dakota. And it has to do with something that was on the front page of the New York Times. And he liked the idea, and it made me really excited. And I could see something in a sort of a current moment that made sense for the issues he was exploring. And maybe if I wasn't in the same field, I might not have been able to do that. And then other times we suggest readings to each other, and that's like very wonderful.
No, I agree. I think that it's you know, like any relationship, you set your boundaries too, and maybe it's not like, I'd like to hear your criticism about this cut. But I think...
Yeah, no, yeah.
I think, you know, maybe there's a sort of... There's another way that support can come in or mm-hmm. something. Or, you know, you might send your work to this place or that place. Or,
right.
You know, I saw this thing that you might want to see or something. And mm-hmm. it is, you know, very sweet, I would say, and supportive to, you know, for 24 years, we've been going to things like, you know, Ellen Berliner's films, and you know, we went to see Keith Sanborn's show at MoMA the other night, and you know, we went together, and no one else would care to go with either of us, you know. Mm-hmm. And there's something kind of, it's weird and outré and wonderful, and we can go together and we can appreciate it together.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to say, I wanted to say something about the having a live-in critic, because we don't actually show each other our work on a constant kind of in that sort of rhythm.
Mm-hmm.
I was editing my film Your Day Is My Night. I'd been editing intensely for a year, going in this one direction in 2013, and I said, "All right, Mark, I'm ready for you to look at it," which He did not follow my script. My script was that he was supposed to tell me how good it was and that he was so happy that it had come along. And he told me how terrible it was, and that the whole thread, which was sort of like an experimental narrative, was sappy, and that nobody would buy it, accept it. And I cried. And actually for weeks, I was so angry with him.
Mm-hmm.
And then somehow I realized that I could climb my way out of the hole, and that he was right. But there's like that thin line between honest, you know, not a thin line, but, you know, do you really want honesty from the person you most respect, or do you want them just to be your
right, of course,
on your fan,
just your champion, fan. And champion, you're just right. Yeah. So, Mark, what's your side of that experience?
I don't remember being that harsh about it. I really don't. Thank you. I really don't. I don't.
By the way, I want to just interject. It's a really great film, and anybody listening should seek it out. Your Day is My Night. It's a terrific film. Despite Marx.
Yeah, I mean, I guess on some well, the great film is not the one I saw.
No, I understand.
You know, I think there are other times when something is almost done or something, mm-hmm. and we're sort of looking for an affirmation or something. But you know, I think you were at a time when you knew it didn't work or something. And I'm trying to think of a similar, mm-hmm. a similar situation. I think you're much more receptive to criticism. I think that's very true. You're much more community oriented, Lynn, and you will seek out tons of advice and tons of criticism, and you'll take it. And I tend to be much more hermetic. So, mm-hmm. so that's a big difference. And
that has nothing to do with like trusting or not trusting your own instincts. It's just a thing. It's just a style thing. It's a personality thing, right? I mean, so you wait until you're showing it, and then people respond to it positively or negatively, right?
Yeah, I guess I'm.
Whereas maybe
I'm
you're
more comfortable.
You're doing
out
a soft market testing a little bit, Lynn, right? A little bit.
Yeah, I'm. You know, I'm out of my own more, and also you create community around your films, and I tend mm-hmm. to dispel community mm. when I'm making my films.
Yours are more Well, from what I see, I could see it that it's more internal. You're going external a bit.
Yeah, Lynn
doesn't
has.
Mean you're not exploring similar ground.
Yeah, I mean. You have a larger production unit and things like that. And I tend to sort of work on my own and things like that. So.
And there are these diaries you're just shooting and you're talking, right, over, or you're recording a separate audio track or something, but sounds like you're there recording as you shoot.
Yeah, I am. That's, you know, even the ones that aren't diary films are generally just very sort of, I'm going out and shooting. I'm mm-hmm. sometimes processing the film myself in the mm-hmm. basement, and it's very kind of a sealed off environment in some ways, which good and bad. But mm-hmm. I think we're different personalities too.
Yeah, reminds me of when I was married and I was working in the music industry. I was writing music and I was playing, singing, performing, and my ex, my wife was a singer. You know, and she's an actress, but she was more focused as a singer at the time. And I just remember sort of a similar, very different styles, very different music. Very, you know, I was writing my own songs and had a real I was surprised by how much of an influence I had on her. You know, it was very surprising to me, and like that she got where I was coming from. Like that's what I took from it. She got me like. She understood it in a way that nobody understood it. In a way, one of the real successful aspects of our marriage, or relationship, I should say, was that like a certain. And then I learned a lot about where she was coming from. I just sort of see. I know what you mean, you know, a little bit, and it's. Yeah, it's an interesting. Component. You guys live it more day and night, though, obviously, because it's been decades of now where you're making films, and at times I'm sure you're working on projects simultaneously, right, and going off and doing your own thing.
The other side is that we have two girls, mm-hmm. so we've raised an 18-year-old and a 20-year-old, and I'm just thinking about something. We went to Italy, I think it was in 2007, and this was in Spain, excuse me. Mm-hmm. We were in Spain, and we went to the city of Girona. And we happened to look in a book and find out, oh, they had a film museum. And, of course, we only had a day there. So somebody else would have wanted to see the churches or basilica, whatever, those kinds of things mm-hmm. In Spain, or something more historic, like long-term European historical. But we both said, no. We have a day here. We're going to go to the cinema museum. Mm-hmm. And it was extraordinary. Mm. They had zoetropes. They had early you know, Nickelodeon film. They had cameras. They had every, you know, and the girls loved it. And it was just extraordinary. Wow. And it was sort of like we were making our pilgrimage.
Yeah.
And both of us were just agreed that that was what we would do in our the one day in that town.
Who? Where is this? Where is this city?
It's in northeastern part of Spain.
Northeastern. So not so by
sort
the
of near the Pyrenees. Or a little closer to the water.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. Okay. Oh, Spain, right. I keep thinking Italy.
Yeah, I said Jerome.
Yes, I do. So you're talking...
Not
so
it's Genoa,
not far from Barcelona,
Jerome.
Maybe.
Yeah, not far from Barcelona at all.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. I wish I had known.
And it was fantastic.
There.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
And, you know...
Spanish.
Yeah.
Like, who the...
Yeah, and so I've since a lot of people knew about that. We didn't. We
what
just
was
there?
What was there?
Accident.
I mean, I guess they did shoot some spaghetti westerns in Spain.
They had a lot of proto-cinematic things, like sort of like at the American Museum of Moving Image in Queens, like different, you know, different, you know, optical toys and things.
That I understand, but Queens even has a history of where things were shot there, you know, like early on in cinema.
I think it was a colonial thing. It was like, you know, the collecting of these toys or something. I mean, that's the way I read it, you know, and there were... I don't even remember, but these things that where you can look at something on one side and see a shadow, you know, hold it up to the light and see the shadow, and it was amazing.
Hmm.
You were asking about the sort of correspondence between our relationship and our art making. So, about 10 years ago, we started a little business. I won't say it's a money maker, not like selling lemonade on the front stairs, but we call it XY Chromosome Project.
Mm-hmm.
And it started because we did some live performances with film at Monkey Town, which was this, did you ever go to Monkey Town?
No.
It was this amazing venue in Williamsburg, like in the early arty days of Williamsburg.
Mm-hmm.
And you could go there and eat meals, and you had to sit very low on the floor.
Mm-hmm.
And you were eating inside the delicious food, and it was like a cube. And so you could sit on anywhere on the four walls of the room, and they projected on every wall. And the whole evening lasted about the length of time for a dinner. And people could bring children, too.
Mm-hmm.
And so we did live shows there with music and, like,
what
live
years are we talking about?
That would have been around 2005, 6, 7,
oh,
something like that.
That's a bit longer.
Yeah, yeah, recently.
Your kids were teenagers, yeah.
Not quite, a little
right,
bit.
A
they
little
were
younger.
In elementary school.
Okay.
And so it was the kind of thing where they could go, mm-hmm. but it wasn't for kids, but you could bring kids. And the people who owned Monkey Town also were as into art, into food as they were into art.
Mm-hmm.
And it ended up traveling to some other cities. I think it was in Denver, and it was in Europe at one point. And it was...
In
Madrid.
Barcelona.
Yeah. So Monkey Town was amazing, and they had a great website. And mm-hmm. so we did quite a few shows there. And that was sort of the beginning. We came up with XY Chromosome Project because we were thinking about, well, of course, about DNA and the man and the woman. But also we were kind of thinking about, well, it, you know, is there something that I might bring that was part of being a woman's experience that might be recognizably different? And that's that kind of traces the path of feminism. Instead of saying we're all the same, mm-hmm. say that, okay, sometimes I see things and do things and make things and witness things in a different way from you. And how can we play on that instead of saying it's just all art? We also have perspectives.
Let's just kind of wind down. Let's just mention maybe certain things that you're doing now because people could look for your work coming up. I know, Mark, you've been really, I don't know about right now, but for a while there this past winter, spring, it sounded like you were really busy.
Well, I finished this diary film called Still Here, which sort of deals with the... empty nest, which mm-hmm. you're sitting in, I guess,
mm-hmm.
here. And, you know, I don't stay in the narcissistic mode, but I'm happy to go there every 6 or 7 years and make a film there.
Mm-hmm.
I made my first diary film called January Journal in 1985 at Bart College during,
Your senior year, right?
Freshman year, you know.
Wait a minute.
Yes.
85,
yeah.
I mean, that was your freshman year.
Yes.
I thought you graduated
86. Well, then it was sophomore year or something. I think I shot it.
I thought you went 83 or something. Anyway, go ahead.
I shot it in my sophomore year, and I ended up finishing it my junior year, so 85. Yeah, I graduated in 86. You're right. Sorry, glad you guys are keeping track, because I can't.
The timeline here.
It's true. But anyway, 85, you know, through a sort of raucous journal of young adulthood in San Francisco called Lilting Towards Chaos, another one called A Year about 8 or 9 years ago. But anyway, you know, I you know, every once in a while I like to check in with that genre, and I was interested in you know, sort of charting this idea of the kids leaving the house and what that's about and renegotiating, I don't know, stuff like that. So that's one thing. And then the last thing I'll say is that, you know, I'm trying to shoot this, I guess, more conventional documentary out in North Dakota.
Yeah, came up earlier.
Oil Town, and it's about a boom town.
Yeah.
In North Dakota. And, you know, it has to do with the sort of flux of you know, people moving there to work and then moving away and stuff like that. So I keep going back. I think I'm following it kind of like, I don't know, I mean, like a Wiseman film where you keep going back and you just keep charting the story and seeing how it changes and things like that. So that's, you know, that's what I'm up to, you know.
So what am I up to? Well,
and I have some ideas.
A couple of things.
I'm on your newsletter.
You have an idea.
At least one of the two.
Because, just to reveal all, I'm working on a project, which Adam is one of the featured participants, and it's called Tip of My Tongue, and it started out as a series of poems that I wrote when I turned 50. I thought, oh, that's an important year. So I wrote a poem for every year of my life. It actually took me a couple of years to write them all.
I bet.
But, They were supposed to be as a framework about the intersection of something very, very private that is in some ways in the shadow of larger things, but also the larger things become in the shadow of it, and that sense of scale becomes flip-flopped, and I kind of call it an inverted history. And it's been a thread in my work all for decades, I'd say, that push-pull between the private and the public, and between community and between home. And so I decided to involve other people who had lived that same century, or half century, not century yet, but half century. And that way that we all have different perspectives on some shared events. So I actually interviewed and worked with Adam on that piece, and so I have a pretty good cut of that, skeleton.
Right.
And now I'm building on that with found imagery from San Francisco that I got from Craig Baldwin. So that's coming along. And then the other thing that I'm doing, and it's not that I'm always working on two projects, but I happen to be, is that I'm doing a piece called Every Fold Matters, which is really looking into what happens in a laundromat. How do people interact with each other when their clothes are being washed, and the fabric becomes like skin, and there's a kind of intimacy and a kind of charged series of dialogues between people. And it's a hybrid, which is a lot of what I'm doing these days, a hybrid of fiction and documentary, a year of documentary work with translators and everything all over Brooklyn and Manhattan, talking to people who work in laundromats. So we did live shows, a bunch of live shows, and now we're making a film out of it.
Wow.
So those are my two projects.
Wow. Well, thank you. First of all, thanks for doing this with me. And it's great. I really enjoyed spending time with you guys. Yeah. And
we feel like it's a gift that you got us together and recorded it.
Yeah. Thank you.
That's totally special thing for us.
Oh, that's great to hear.
Yeah.
Good, because I just had this in my in mind for a while to do something like this, you know. And it surpassed all my expectations too.
Oh, great. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's nice to hang out. I feel like we're sitting here, and I keep thinking, if these microphones could talk, Mm-hmm. You know, what has gone into these microphones?
That's true.
All your recordings.
And oh, I hadn't thought about that.
It's a storied history. You know?
Well, there's a few really good conversations. And, you know, Alan Berliner came up a few times. I mean, what a great storyteller. And he's definitely would be in there. And Al Maisel's, you know.
Yeah. I will ask you something as a somewhat quasi-historian. Where are you archiving all of this?
I delete them after I finish. I just don't even post them because they just...
it's all about not process, but yeah. What's the opposite?
The moment to spot...
What's that called? It's all process, no product.
Yeah, the shows... Well, first of all, The shows are you know, they're on a number of places. You can find them on the right now on Rooftop Films website, on my own website, the latest episode. They're all there, and on iTunes, of course. And then, you know, I have all the original. I shouldn't say that. I have a great deal of it. The raw files. I keep all that backed up, but the majority of it could be probably all put together. The show edited shows, they're all at my fingertips. And you know, there's been with the recent Guy Madden, there's who came on, he was 600th person on the show. Now that doesn't mean that's my 600th episode or 600th segment. It's half that. It's just that I've had on, you know, shows like this where I have two people, you know. And so.
And then you get somebody with a multiple personality disorder.
that just
adds to it.
I count each one, exactly. And if I'm trying to reach a threshold, I'll just, you know, as many people with multiple personality disorders is great. And then you get people, sometimes politicians on, who have actually no personality. So then it just sort of happens up balancing it out.
Minus one, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's been, sometimes you just get into these really great conversations, and hopefully it'll all be, you know, end up in this incredible archive, as you're suggesting. I think conversations like these are really special.
Because it'll all fit on a hard drive. You could donate it to Anthology or Pacific Film Archive or somewhere where you would know it would be safe.
Oh, that's true. Yeah. Yeah, or so you're talking about like all the edited shows?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or even archive.org, is it? The Rick Prelinger thing.
I don't know what that is, but I'm interested.
Archive.org, it's amazing.
Really?
Yeah, it's like, I don't know, it's Rick Prelinger's old archive of films, but they also have sounds and stuff like that, and anybody can upload.
It's open source, I guess you call it. Interesting. I got to check it out.
Yeah. No, I'll give you the link. It's pretty amazing.
Okay, great. Well, thanks.
Thank you both.
By the way, for more information about both of these fine artist filmmakers, you can go to linsacks.com for Lynn's Films, linsacchs.com. MarkStreetFilms.com for Mark Films, okay? Here we go. Last up, my conversation with the cinematographer, Tim Orr. Just a quick look on his IMDb page. You know, his career really does just start with David Gordon Green's film. He was director of photography for George Washington, All the Real Girls, Undertow. He was also on The Baxter, which is not David's film, of course. He was the DP on Snow Angels, which is back to David. Choke, Pineapple Express, back to David. Observe and Report, Eastbound and Down. He did
bunch of episodes. He did Your Highness, The Sitter. Both of those are Greens. And Prince Avalanche and Joe. Both of those are David Gordon Green. So I'm kind of popping around here. But Manglehorns. And most recently, Our Brand is Crisis, which just came out a couple months ago, if that long. So I think he's been the DP on every single David Gordon Green feature, though I may be wrong. He was just, like I said, Zephyr Zachariah, which is Craig Zobel's film. And they're all part of that North Carolina Mafia that we're going to talk about on this conversation. Here it is. This is my conversation with cinematographer Tim Orr. How are you? Sorry, first of all, for my, I don't know, I should have realized you were in L.A. It makes perfect sense. So pardon me for texting you, like.
Good idea. I'll lay back to sleep. I'm in Portland, Oregon, by the way.
Oh, you're in Portland.
Yeah.
Oh, it does say that on your status, but I couldn't be sure if that was up to date or not. So how long have you lived in Portland, Oregon?
Like 4.5 years.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, I've done my time in New York and Los Angeles. You know?
So the sentence is over, in other words.
Well, yeah. I mean, I came here from L.A. Like, I'd, you know, lived in New York for a while, and it was great. You know, then we had kids, and then wanted to, try out Los Angeles, try to get into doing some, you know, slightly bigger movies at the time. And, you know, L.A. was just never really for me.
Yeah.
And so then I never worked there. I was always somewhere else. So I wanted to, so we decided to live where we wanted to live. It works out pretty well.
That does. And since you brought it up already, and what's the perfect film in the sense of the size for you these days?
Well, if we're talking budget level, it's kind of in that $30 million range.
Uh-huh.
Because it kind of gives you usually enough time, you get the gear that you need, more or less. You're at a level to where the stakes are, you know, as long as you're making your days and people are happy with the dailies, that you're kind of hopefully left alone to make the movie. And you don't feel those, some of the things that you feel on lower budget indie movies.
Right.
That aside, I always, and this is why I kind of bounce back and forth between doing, you know, studio pictures and indie movies, is I always really kind of prefer those, you know, true indie movies, you know, whether or not, you know, the budget, you know, is now like $3 million or $4 or whatever. Because, you know, like usually the subject matter, the script, the subject matter, the, you know, everyone involved there, you have a lot more creative freedom. And that's certainly something that it's like if a PAVE was no, if you didn't have to go out in the world and make a living at times, I would just do those. Just because they're so much more really satisfying.
How does the scrutiny of doing a studio picture affect you in a direct way?
Well, there's an expected look within, you know, what's expected of a studio comedy to look like. And that's something that I've tried in the ones I've done. I've tried to stretch that as much as I can into something that looks a little bit more naturalistic, that, you know, I try to ride the line of something that is not just some kind of like paint-by-numbers, high-key, glossy, you know, emotionless, you know, photography. It's, I try to get away with as much as I can. But that said, it's like you still have to ride that line of delivering something that is commercially acceptable. That still delivers like the more or less the expected look that the producers and the studio executives they expect. You'll get in situations where it's like, say, whether it's a night scene or whether it's, you know, it's like, oh, maybe that's a little too dark. You know, it just is like just a general example.
Like The Sitter is an example. It seemed like a lot of that was shot in the evening.
Well, The Sitter was, you know, a movie that was shot, with the exception of the first maybe 10 minutes of it, was all at night. And it sort of strays into like a different subject. But you know, it's just kind of like anything else. You're expected, along with the director and the first AD gets tied into this, to come in and make your days and stay on budget. And hopefully everyone's happy with the daily.
Right.
It's those times where it's like, you know, maybe you have a different creative opinion of how something should look, and the producers and or studio execs think it should look like something else. I haven't had that problem, so I've steered clear of that.
Right. So let's go back a little bit in time here. What was your own start in film? I would guess that every DP goes to films that there's no other way to become a DP, at least to learn on the job. Seems real, that would be a real slow learning curve.
Yeah, that's a good question. So I personally, when I was in my early 20s, I went to a liberal arts college, gotten a worthless degree in political science. I had no idea what I wanted to do coming out of high school. And I spent a few years, like, you know, say 3 years or so, kind of working a lot of different jobs, a lot of crappy jobs. I worked in a light bulb factory. I worked in a fish hatchery. I sold vinyl siding and replacement windows for a very brief amount of time. That was a terrible job. I worked as a, you know, like in a grocery store. It's like I had a lot of crappy jobs. And during that time, I was like really trying to figure out what I wanted to do, you know. In that era, I kind of started, you know, I was reading a lot of like novels, you know, I began painting, even though I'm not a very skilled painter. I began, you know, taking, photographs whenever I could. And I kind of got into watching independent cinema, foreign films,
right.
Independent cinema, stuff that I'd never seen before, like, you know, growing up. I grew up in North Carolina, and I would only see what was, like, on TV or at my local movie theater. So it became an artistic awakening of sorts, and I just kind of got to a point where I was like, well, I don't want to work in this grocery store all my life, and if I could do anything, what would it be? I want to do that. I want to make movies. So there was around that time, there was a film school in North Carolina, North Carolina School of the Arts, that was just starting. That's a school. It's kind of a conservatory of sorts, and acting, a drama program, you know, production design, dance, music, and so they expanded and opened a film school. And so I was like, perfect. I applied. I got. And yes, I went to film school and met a lot of people there that I still work with. David Green,
Craig.
Richard Reich, production designer, Craig Zobel, another director, mm-hmm. Danny McBride went there, Jody Hill, et cetera, and so forth. I'm leaving out probably, 20 other people. But I did go to film school. And I think one of the best things that comes out of film school, at least for me, and I think many other people may say this, it's who you meet. It's the people you meet and those relationships you forge in school that sometimes leads to, you know, working together in your professional career, or at the very least just access to ideas and opportunities. So it was good for me. But that said, it's like I think that it is in some ways harder to work your way up. Say so you didn't go to film school and say you just started as like a loader on a film set. Well, it's like you're probably, and this is the way it used to be in the old, like, whether I call it the old days or like just kind of like the old studio system, even through probably the 60s, 70s, up through that era. That was really, if you were going to become a cinematographer, you're going to work your way up through the ranks. Mm-hmm. say, the camera department, you know, loader, assistant, operator, DP. And it could take years. It could take 20 years. It could take 30 years. That doesn't seem to happen as much anymore. There are people that certainly kind of work their way up a bit, but I think that there are certain shortcuts that are taken, whether or not, say, someone is interested in becoming a cinematographer and they are like an assistant. Well, if they really want to be a DP, it's like a lot of the time, it's like they just, you know, a lot of the time shoot whatever they can, whether it be shorts, whether it be spec commercials, whether it be, you know, a super low budget, no budget features. They're, you know, going to be in some ways taking the same track as someone, a cinematographer coming out of film school. Because there is certainly a lot of, you know, it becomes ambition and luck. And there's certainly in some ways a lot of luck involved in getting to the place to where you can, you know, be a working cinematographer.
Going back to the North Carolina School of the Arts, was that what it was called?
Yes.
Was there any special bond or synergy, artistic, aesthetic synergy that you automatically felt with Green? Because obviously, I mean, I don't know if you can look back and identify that, because obviously the two of you have gone on to really forge quite a relationship.
Yeah, it's a kind of a good story in a way. You know, David and I never really worked. We only worked together on one project in film school. You know, we knew each other, but we really didn't share hardly any of the same classes. We didn't, our, you know, like, we, although we knew each other, we hung out with kind of different groups of friends in a way. We were there, our first film project, well, like whenever in that school, it's like the first 2 years, you do a bit of everything. And then, the second two years, you are, you apply to become like either a director or a writer or a cinematographer. And I chose cinematography, and David was a director. And so the first project that was a film project, that both for the directors and the cinematographers, you got paired up with someone, and David and I got paired up together. And it was a documentary. David, this was solely David's idea, and it was, and I was just there to photograph it. It was on the artificial insemination of cows. Mm-hmm. So we went out to this farm, and it was basically, you know, how a cow is artificially inseminated, which is a pretty gross process. But, you know, like we, you know, spent a couple of days doing this, it was really the first time that he and I had really kind of at length talked or hung out, you know? And, you know, we discovered we shared a lot of similar interests and certainly a lot of similar artistic instincts, for lack of a better phrase. And that was the only thing we collaborated on in school. And then after we got out of film school, we were both living in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. And a group of us had went on a camping trip. And then we came back. And then I think I remember David, you know, pitching this idea of George Washington to me. And saying, you know, he was basically like, well, I'm going to join the Marines. I want to make this movie. And I was like, great, you should make this movie. And he had asked me to shoot it. And I was like, of course, would love to. So a year after we graduated, basically, we found ourselves back in North Carolina and back in Winston-Salem. And we were making George Washington. And that was the first feature. And then we just kind of kept going from there.
Yeah, well, maybe we can come back to the question of the fact that you kept coming back together time and time again. That in and of itself seems fairly unusual. So a few years later, you did the cinematography for The Baxter, which is the Michael Showalter. And did you also find yourself falling into that group, that clique of people? Because I know that they went on, of course, to Wet Hot American Summer and a bunch of other things. It was like a whole sort of second school. There was the North Carolina Mafia, then there was this group, right?
Well, yeah, and I wasn't that much a part of that group. I think really The only thing, I mean, if you're referring to Michael Showalter, David Wayne, those guys, I think the only thing I really did with them was the Baxter.
Yeah.
But that was a great time. Michael had seen my work before, and I really liked the script. I thought it was very charming, and very much like an older Hollywood, you know, kind of like throwback. Like, you know, it felt to me like it was a contemporary version of a movie from the 30s. And I really liked that. But that was the only thing Michael and I did together. But it was a great time. Everyone involved was just, you know, super lovely.
Mm-hmm.
That was the only thing I didn't really kind of run in those circles otherwise.
I understand. I mean, those guys have really also created a whole thing for themselves as well, which is
fun. Like a group that stays together and collaborates together all the time. And yeah. I think that's really great. You know, love what they do.
I mean, I don't know if a lot of people listening know that you guys also were all very involved, you and David, Danny McBride, of course, in the Eastbound and Down series that you shot a bunch of those, right? You and maybe did
I shot the first season of Eastbound and Down.
Just the first season. Did Jody shoot a lot of those too? Is that?
Well, you know, the first season, there was only one episode I worked with Jody on. Everything else, because Jody at the time was finishing editorial on Observe and Report.
Oh, I see.
I did not shoot the pilot. Jody had directed the pilot, and then I did the rest of the first season. And David Green and Adam McKay did most of those episodes.
Did you like doing television?
I like doing television for HBO.
Why was that? I mean, not that you necessarily had a lot of other television experience, but what about it? The HBO aspect, was it that you were left alone?
Yeah, I mean, we were totally left alone to do whatever we wanted. And I think that one of the reasons why that show, whether, you know, there are people that are either going to love it or hate it for usually, you know, more or less the subject matter, we thought it was just hysterically funny, and we had a great time making it. They've left those guys alone the entire time to do whatever they want. And I think that's one of the reasons why the show hits the chord that it hits with people, and that it's really good. You know, it's really funny. So it's great whenever, as long as you hopefully know what you're doing and you're making your days and you're staying more or less on track and on schedule and on budget, that ideally, like, the filmmakers are left alone to make the film or to make the show or whatever it is. And it kind of goes back to just kind of trusting who you hire. And I think they've certainly done that with those guys, with Jody and Danny and David, with Eastbound. And I think it turned into something really interesting.
How was working with, two notoriously larger-than-life actors? I almost said characters, and maybe that wouldn't have been wrong either way to describe them. But you have Nicolas Cage and Al Pacino. They're both, I think, had great... I think David got great performances out of both of them, more sort of tuned in than ever into character and into the narrative, less explosive and... what was that like?
Yeah, they were both total pros. They, you know, both, you know, showed up very prepared. And, both Nick and Al have been doing this a very long time. And they're very accomplished, as you said. Like, really, they've delivered some brilliant performances over the years. And, I think that for both of them, you know, for Nick hadn't done a movie like Joe in a long time. And I think really for that particular character, maybe really never, you know, it was a bit more of an understated kind of brooding, quieter performance in some ways that really resonated. I think I thought he was great in it. And Al's doing something that was in a way similar, you know, this kind of like quieter, smaller, but still kind of big presence. You know, that's one of the things about those guys. It's like that they have a very big presence, even though if the character they're playing is, you know, they're not going to be the loudest guy in the room in this particular story. Well, but they still occupy in that charisma something that is somewhat larger than life.
Well, definitely true. But you know, it seems like the performances were not self-referential in any way. Like, this is Al Pacino as, you know what I mean? It's sort of, this is, you know, Manglehorn is the character.
Exactly.
Is, you know, and
yeah, ain't right, Joe. And so, and David really, I think, they, you know, it's a credit to David and the actors, Nick and Al, of, like, really, you know, digging deep and coming up with something that felt true, you know? And to a certain degree different from what both of them had been doing for a little while. But yeah, I think David did a great job getting super performances out of both of them. And I think both of them enjoyed the process very much too. You know, like the on set, like kind of just the way we work on set, like the, you know, one thing, you know, like working on the movies I've worked with David on, especially the indie movies, it's just it's a great way to work, you know. It just feels very, you know, it's an atmosphere that kind of gets created that it's kind of inspiring. Of, you know, like it's a very inspired atmosphere, and I think it filters through everyone that's working on it.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure they were, you know, found it very appealing to get back to kind of, quote unquote, their roots in the way of, you know, again, much more of a story-driven film and character-driven film. And they obviously, both their people and their camps had to do a lot of scrutiny. So they obviously liked what they saw from your films in the past, yours and David's films. So that had to feel good. Well, you know, before we finish, we should talk, I guess, a little bit about the latest project, which, as you said before, you do oscillate between true indie and studio films, and your new one, I guess, is a studio film. Our Brand is Crisis, right?
Yes, that was we shot that last year in New Orleans and Puerto Rico.
Uh-huh.
It just premiered, I think, yesterday or the day before in Toronto,
uh-huh.
And I think it's been pretty well received. You know, it's based on the documentary from a few years ago about a Bolivian presidential election and an American campaign team that is kind of managing the presidential bid of one of the candidates. And Sandra Bullock and Billy Bob Thornton were the stars, and I think it's pretty interesting. You know, it's one of those movies, it's predominantly a drama, but it definitely has like a lot of lighter moments that are pretty funny. But it was a pleasure to make, and, you know, hopefully people will go see it.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing it. David was on a couple of months ago because he's been working at such a tear. I guess Manglehorn just came out theatrically. He did this podcast and was telling me already about it. I didn't realize it was already going to be a TIFF. It was that quick. It's got a great cast. I mean, you know, Billy Bob Thornton, too, and then Anthony Mackie and a bunch of indie actors. I mean, Ann Dowd, nice to see her. She has worked with Craig and Scott McNeary. I wonder where the next festival is going to be, just personally, so I can try to check it out sooner than...
I'm not really sure. Yeah. I know it's coming out in October.
Oh, that's right around the corner, so this is probably...
Soon. Toronto may be the only thing it does. I'm not really sure.
You may be right.
I think it's late October it's coming out.
Yeah, which is going to sneak up right up on us. Well, I feel like this is just barely scratching the surface. And
great.
Did I leave anything out?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know. Like I said, there's a lot of things that you know that can be talked about, but it would be a much longer thing.
Yeah.
I think for what we covered, you know, there's hopefully some interesting things.
For sure, and I think a lot of young filmmakers or film students that are kind of grappling with, you know, the idea of maybe what about being a DP? You know, I mean, I think that getting your firsthand experiences and the way you talked about it is going to be very helpful to them. You know, I think there's probably a lot of, I don't know if the pressure is the right word, but it seems like there might be. I don't know. It's interesting, I guess, at that young an age when you're, you know, maybe in your early 20s or so, to
say, well, I'm going to be a cinematographer, it seems still very, seems like an odd choice almost. I mean, a perfectly great choice, of course, but it does seem like, you know, most people would want the glory, quote unquote, of being a director, an auteur.
I don't know people. I mean, maybe there's some, but I don't think that that many people, you know, like when they're like, you know, 11, 12, 15, whatever, say, I want to be a cinematographer. Maybe there are some people that do, but I think most people that say they want to go to film school, and I certainly did, they want to be a writer-director. That's most people that go to film school. Not, you know, some maybe are interested in producing and just writing or something. Or, but I think it is something that I didn't intend on being a cinematographer. I wanted to be, I when I went to film school, I was more interested in writing and directing. And then once I was exposed to it as a craft, I discovered it was something that I was good at and that I really liked. It was the most interesting aspect of filmmaking to me. And so I think a lot of people do discover it in that way.
And did you find that, because I know you said you dabbled, and this is what led up to your deciding to go to an art school, that you had already been, not to in any way to de-emphasize the importance of it, but you were dabbling in different arts and mediums like photography and painting, as you said. And then you got interested in art film, maybe Truffaut and the New Wave and the Italians. I'm just guessing.
Yes, that's pretty accurate, yeah.
And then Cassavetes, of course, who is the ubiquitous go-to guy for so many generations of filmmakers. But, like, you thought, as a DP, I could actually help create films that, you know, are inspired by that kind of artistic power and that maybe help create it, like something like that for people. You know, you can be part of a team. You don't always have to be the auteur, you know?
Well, yeah, I think that's certainly part of it. And, you know, for me, honestly, it was just accessing something that I'd never thought about. And it was kind of like the continuing opening blossom of something. Like before, I'd never thought about making movies. I'd never thought about, I could do this. But it was something, you know, like I think that cinematography is just one of those things. What I'd never thought of, I never thought of it as a possibility in filmmaking until it's like I was exposed to it and really thought about it more and practiced it. And what I found like the most interesting or what I gravitated was, you know, lighting and, you know, how you kind of craft and shape light and how light can help tell a story. And I don't know, that was just something that was like a kind of a revelation to me, and it's something I really latched on to.
Yeah, last thing. I mean, are there any DPs that you look back at as like among your favorites? It's kind of a cheesy question.
Yeah, I mean, usually I kind of have. I mean, certainly there are so many brilliant cinematographers over the course of cinema history, but the two that have kind of, you know, like Conrad Hall and Harris Savides are my two favorites in terms of people who, like, I just admired their eye and you know, their lighting, their framing, everything. I guess those guys come closest to like kind of my instincts, mm-hmm. I guess. Mm-hmm. To me, it's like those guys, Conrad and Harris were just two best to me.
Oh, okay. And Cervetes died recently, right?
Yeah, he died a couple of years ago.
Yeah, just a couple of years ago. And Conrad, what did he make?
Well, Conrad, well, you know, he did stuff from Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid to Searching for Bobby Fischer and American Beauty and Road to Perdition. And, like, he has a long, you know, like a Marathon Man, I believe. And, you know, he had shot a bunch of classics through the 70s. It was just consistently, you know, a brilliant cinematographer.
He's still around though, right?
No, he died about 10 years ago.
So I guess I'm going to, don't invite on show, cross that out.
Yeah, which you could, believe me.
I know. I would have you there with me, trust me. Hey, listen, thanks again. And let's try to do this again. Maybe one time when you're in New York, let's try to put aside
and you know, and meet up, because I've been an admirer of your work, going back to George Washington, and seriously, it's been, you've been somebody who I've wanted. I'm like, why haven't I done this yet? And so, thanks for responding so quickly and helping make this happen so quickly.
Okay, great. Well, thank you, Adam. I appreciate it.
All right, I'll let you back to your weekend.
Okay, take care.
You too. Wish everybody a very happy new year. Have fun, be safe, be well, and we'll see you, of course, in 2016 on the next episode of the podcast. I'm just trying to move things forward, bring in nothing but the finest guests. Again, as I said at the beginning of the show, I do appreciate your listening. I want to just also, again, thank the Vermont College of Fine Arts MFA Film Program for their sponsoring a number of episodes at the end of 2015 and going into 2016. Do, again, check it out online and find out as much as you can about this exceptional film program. Thank you very much, everybody, for listening to Film Wax Radio this past year. My name is Adam Shartoff, the host of Film Wax Radio. Until next time, Happy New Year.